something like that. And I think the weather's a little bit different here compared to California. But these areas quantum information. So you heard the talk from Ray about quantum computers and quantum technology and quantum cryptography and those types of things. So that's Carlos's general area of research. And one area within that is quantum teleportation. And so I've just actually talked to them about entanglement, a very hand-wavy, descriptive way in shared set theorem. So, oh, Carlos.
Okay. Today we're going to talk about quantum teleportation, which you know, you may have seen from your well, the idea of teleportation is sort of a favorite notion of science fiction, of Star Trek, whatever it is, and there is sort of a real version of that that actually occurs in the real world. Maybe a little bit different from what goes on in Star Trek, but nevertheless, that's what we're going to be talking about. I'll give a presentation, and at the end, we're going to have an experiment that's going to show, we're going to teleport something. So for that, I'm going to need a volunteer from the audience, a very brave volunteer. Yes, can you tell your name to the audience, please?
I'm Julian.
Julian.
Yeah.
Very good. So our very own Julian is going to be our first telenaut. Is that properly spelled? Yes.
That's right.
Okay, so hopefully, I want you to pay close attention to what's going on because Julian's safety depends on this. You may have heard what happened at last year's ISSYT when our unfortunate victim, Mark, unfortunately got teleported into the middle of the lake. But we fixed the machine this year, I promise. And, you know, probably he'll be safe at the end of this. I hope. So, okay. What is teleportation? Roughly speaking, we're going to have a lab A, and we're going to have a lab B. Inside lab A, there's going to be a box. Inside lab B, there's going to be a box.
Wow.
Julian is going to climb into the first box. He will then magically appear in the second box in lab B. Anything that we put inside box A should magically appear inside box B. So let's just forget about quantum mechanics. Let's forget about all the troubles, all the stuff that you might have been learning this week, and let's just assume that the world is classical. Classical physics. Can we do teleportation as I define it?
No.
Let's try that again. Can we do teleportation as I define it?
No.
Yes. Let me explain to you how we can do teleportation as I define it. It's actually very simple. It's roughly called a truck. We take whatever's in box A, we load it onto the truck. The truck drives over to lab B, we unload the cargo over here, and presto exchange-o, we have ourselves teleportation. So yeah. Okay, so we don't want trucks. So let's put our no truck condition. How are we going to prevent trucks? We're going to build a wall between the two labs. It's going to be a very, very big wall that's going to surround them, and it's going to be impermeable to trucks, airplanes, lasers, nuclear missiles, and anything else you want. This is going to divide, essentially, universe. Lab A is going to be universe A, and lab B is going to be universe B. Okay, now can we do teleportation?
Sure.
No. The answer is no. roughly speaking, if these are completely separate universes, and what I mean by completely separate is that there is no way to get from lab A to lab B, then by definition, there is no way to get from lab A to lab B, and we're stuck. And that's, you know, maybe the sort of playing of semantics here. But that's what I really mean by two separate universes. There is no way to get from lab A to lab B. They're separate. Okay. So now we took a problem. It was really easy. We changed it a little bit. Now we made it too hard. Can we change it again to make something reasonable? Not too easy, not too hard. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to add a telephone. The telephone is going to allow people in universe A to talk to the people in universe B. It's a simple telephone. Now we ask, can we do teleportation classically?
No.
Yes. 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 If you change the problem, it's going to flip every time. What device does teleportation? Fax machine. Thank you. Very good. We attach a fax machine to the line, comes over here, there's another fax machine, and voila. Okay, maybe it's not a regular fax machine, it's a gigantic three-dimensional fax machine, but that's okay. It's just a really big fax machine. You don't get those at Staples, you gotta order those special. Okay, so our telenaut, Julian, goes into the fax machine over here. He comes out at the fax machine over there. What's wrong with this picture?
There are two.
There are two of them. We like Julian, but we don't like him that much. So what are we going to do?
Destroy one of them.
Yes, we buy a shredder. And we fax it to the output of fax 1. So in goes Julian into the box, crosses through the fax, and into the shredder. The other copy comes out at this other side. Will it be painful for Julian? Well, the one who's sitting here, yes. Very, very painful. The shredder is horribly painful. We have no anesthesia here. This is a physics institution, not a biological research center. But for the Julian that exits your lab B, it will have appeared that he entered the box and instantly appeared here and then walked out of the box with no pain felt. So that's lovely. That's beautiful. We know how to do this. There's another objection which you may have to my fax machine. Nobody's here. Fax machines are notoriously poor quality, if you look at them. Now, that's of course because they were built a long time ago. We could build a better fax machine. But you might say, okay, well, any fax machine is not going to teleport a perfect copy over here. Whatever it is going to be sort of some rough copy. And so if we're destroying the original and we end up with a rough copy, then, you know, that may not be very good. Well, I claim to you that as a physicist, that's perfectly fine. And why is that fine? Well, let's say we forgot it. We went back to the first case, and we put Julian inside the box, inside the truck. And he's going to go and traveling on the truck, shaking, 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 up, down. What's going to happen to him? He's going to get shaken. There's going to be dust that falls on him. Maybe there's a cosmic ray that comes in and hits one of his atoms and you know, sends it crazy out of control. And eventually, the Julian that arrives in lab B is not going to be exactly the same as the Julian that started off in lab A. Even if we send them by truck. It's true. So roughly speaking, it's okay if the Julian that arrived in lab B is a little bit different from when it started. So long as the differences are not all that great. So long as, you know, he's still the you know, happy and unafraid person who volunteered to be a telenaut today. So basically that's fine. So we're gonna accept small errors. So let me write down what we found today. No truck. Yes, phone, and errors okay. Small errors okay. Perfect. This is classical teleportation. We built the classical teleportation device, and now we're happy we can run the experiment and go home. The world is quantum mechanical. And now we have to worry about that. So what does a fax machine roughly do? Well, a fax machine follows the following three steps. One, it measures whatever went into it. Two, it transmits. And I apologize for the spelling of some of these words. Three, it reconstructs an equivalent object based on the information that it was transmitted to based on the measurement that it did in step one. What's the problem with this?
You can't measure everything.
Measurements, exactly. or unexactly in the quantum world. We're stuck at step one. We want to measure all the particles and make a Julian, and we can measure all the positions of all the particles. But then we'll have no idea what the momentum of it is. We can alternatively measure all the momentum of the particles. But then we don't know what the position is. We can measure some of the position and some of the momentum. But the Heisenberg uncertainty principle basically guarantees us that whatever we do, we will never obtain enough information to rebuild even a modestly accurate copy of Julian on the other side. So tough luck to you. So that's a problem. And for roughly 70 years after the discovery of quantum mechanics, people really believe that teleportation was impossible. Well, obviously, I wouldn't be speaking to you today if it were still impossible. And so in 1993, Charlie Bennett, I better get this one right, and five collaborators discovered the idea of quantum teleportation. And this really happened, 70 years after the discovery of quantum mechanics. It's really, a long time in some sense. And so what quantum teleportation is a way of basically teleporting without actually having to go through these steps, without actually having to fully measure a state. Because we know that this way is impossible, but that doesn't mean that every way is possible. So there's a loophole. And that's roughly what we're going to talk about today. Now, I really hate to break it to Julian, but actually, we really don't have a teleportation device here at the PI. We won't be teleporting him at the end of the lecture. Teleportation of people is very, very hard. Very, 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 very hard. But what we'll eventually prove today is that it's not impossible. Traveling faster than the speed of light is impossible. Traveling at 99% of the speed of light is very, very, very hard. Teleporting a human being is very, 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 very hard. Now, the difference between impossible and very hard may not be all that different for some people. Certainly the army, every once in a while, comes around and says, teleportation, that sounds good. Can you build us a device just like that? Maybe we can teleport troops around. And we got to explain to them that we have quantum teleportation. All we really did is we proved that it's not impossible, that it's just very, very hard. And they're never quite impressed with that notion. But for a physicist, there's a huge difference between impossible and very, very, very hard. And that's why, really, this result is very exciting. If you were simply in a classical world, building a teleportation device is, from a physicist's point, trivial. You measure, you send, you reconstruct. And it's a very difficult engineering problem, but it's not obviously it has to do anything with physics. For a very long time, we thought that quantum teleportation was forbidden by physics. With the discovery of quantum teleportation, we realized actually physics does allow. And now we're basically left again with a very, very, very hard engineering problem. But that's for the engineers to figure out, for a physicist. Okay. What is the setup for quantum teleportation? Quantum teleportation. Again, there is a lab A, there is a lab B. There are boxes. There's a wall. There's going to be a phone, which I won't draw very clearly this time. And so, roughly everything is the same. For starters, we need to be a little bit careful with this phone. When we do quantum information, we actually have two kinds of phones. We have classical phones, which can send classical information, and we have quantum phones, which can send quantum information. It turns out that if you have a quantum phone that can send quantum information, then quantum teleportation is trivial. It's kind of like allowing trucks in the classical side. Just sort of, you let them, you just carry, you just use a phone to move stuff through. So we're going to allow only classical phones here. Roughly speaking, what this means is that the telephone will measure every signal that goes through. Every phone that you're accustomed to is a classical phone. All phones out there are classical phones. This is a standard phone that you're accustomed to. Okay, so now we have the same picture. Is this enough? Can we do teleportation like this?
No.
Yeah, well, it's taking a poll, but if you don't really know, it's kind of random. The answer is no. And we need to change the problem a little bit. We need to allow one extra thing. We need to allow entanglement. Entanglement, roughly speaking, is a quantum system that has two parts. And one part of it is going to live in lab A, the entanglement part of A, and the other part of it is going to live in lab B. And there's mysterious quantum correlation that mysteriously crossed the wall, but realistically there's nothing going back and forth. And so, classical phones and entanglement. Okay, I'll give you a very specific example of this entanglement in a few minutes. But I want to begin by exploring what are the consequences of this entanglement. Entanglement basically needs to be created in a single lab. If it has two parts, to create an entangled state, I have to have both parts in the same lab at the beginning. So you can ask, well, we start off, you know, lab A could start off to prepare the entangled state in two parts, and they could try to send the other half to lab B. How would they send the other half? Well, we could say they can use teleportation. But they must have had an entangled state before that to use teleportation. So that's a chicken and egg problem, which I noticed we were looking at earlier today. It's gone now. So that's a problem. Is there any other way of distributing entanglement? If you start off with zero entanglement, the answer is no. So what must have happened, or what we assumed happened somehow, is that way, way in the past, this wall wasn't there. The technicians from lab A and lab B got together for coffee, they sat down, they prepared their entangled state, and then they went back, carried their respective pieces back to lab A and lab B, and put back the wall. Or many years later, somebody built the wall, and now they have to use the entanglement to communicate. That's roughly the idea that you have to have in mind. Maybe you can think of, you know, you have a pair of friends who are, you know, living together in the same city, and then one of them is going to be moving away. And he says to his buddy, hey, you know, we've been friends for a while. How about we share an entangled state? And maybe that sounds a little bit dirty, but I guarantee you it's perfectly safe. And so what they do is they create an entangled state, and then the guy who moves away carries his piece, and now that he went away, he can use that for teleportation with his buddy who stayed at home. But you have to have started with some pair of entanglements. So I can teleport, roughly speaking. I'll continue the metaphor of teleporting people, even though I've sort of discussed already that, you know, roughly speaking, experimentally, we can't quite teleport people. But let's say we really could, in principle we could. I could now use the entanglement to teleport over to any of my friend's labs. Where else could I go? Well, if I can get to my friend's lab, I could then teleport again to my friend's friend's lab. I could teleport to my friend's 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 lab, and so on and so on ad infinitum. I can teleport to the lab of anybody who is ever connected by 6 degrees or n degrees of separation with entanglement with somebody that I know. Can I teleport to the aliens living in the Alpha Centauri system? No, because we don't have any entanglement. We've never shared any entanglement with them. We've never created entanglement, so the answer is no. Until they come visit us or we come visit them, basically, no. Not that there are any aliens in Alpha Centauri that we've discovered, but just so you understand the basic idea. There's another caveat to this. Entanglement is not something that's sort of static. Entanglement is something that's used up. Every time you teleport, you use and destroy a little bit of the entanglement. So if you want to teleport many, many, many times before leaving your friend, you have to bring many, many, many entangled pairs. You have to make sure to bring enough entangled pairs or entangled states so you can perform all the teleportations you want to do, because once you run out, you're going to have to go back and meet up with your friend. You could say, well, why can't we just use our teleportation experiment to teleport some entanglement? Well, it turns out quite nicely that the amount of entanglement that you need to destroy to teleport some entanglement is exactly equal to the amount of entanglement that you ended up teleporting. So you end up with a zero-sum game. Okay. There's one last very important feature of quantum teleportation, which maybe concerns Julian a lot. We were going to destroy Julian in the classical teleportation experiment by running him through the shredder. But that seemed optional. There was no reason why we really had to run him by the shredder. We could have just ended up with two copies. It turns out quite nicely in the quantum world that that's not true. Quantum states can never be cloned, which means you can never make a copy of this state, which means that the only way to teleport to lab B is to have destroyed the original lab A. There is no choice in quantum mechanics. Here we could choose yes or no. In quantum computing, we always have to destroy whatever the lab A. But, you know, for those of you who like exploring, you know, philosophical consequences, you could say that if we can never do there's only one copy at any time, and the copy survives all the way to lab B, you could think of it as that whatever the hell we're destroying in lab A must not have been Julian, because there's only one Julian ever. So that's it's an interesting philosophical thing to ponder, but we're not going to discuss acting philosophy today. We're going to discuss math. So I'm going to write down a little bit of the math that makes quantum teleportation work. So I think you've seen these earlier today, but basically, call it a normal physicist. Would write a vector by putting a little arrow on it. A quantum physicist writes a vector like this, putting a bar on the left and a greater than sign on the right.
A cat.
Is it greater than anything?
No.
No. Good, you've learned this.
Cat.
Why is it called a cat?
Because it's brown.
Good. Because we have physicists have a very good sense of humor. Okay. So you've seen cats. We've been talking about teleporting a whole human person, but really what we can teleport is a spin. So you know little electrons have spins on them. And so we're going to start off with a little electron in lab A, and we're going to teleport its spin to lab B, which means that at the end of the teleportation experiment, the spin of the electron in lab B is going to be exactly the same as the spin of the electron in lab A was before the teleportation experiment. We won't even teleport the position and the momentum of this electron. We're just really going to worry about the spin. So what can we say about spins? Well, there are two spins. There is the up spin, and there is the down spin. And if you want to think of them as vectors, you can think this is a 1-0 vector. I know. You've seen a little bit of this today, and I'll try to review it quickly, but I want to make sure we're all on the same page. 1-0, 0-1, up and down. The most general spin state you can do is A up plus B down. And that's roughly equivalent to AB, the vector. What does this mean physically? Well, there's something called a Stern-Gerlach experiment. What happens when you feed in something into a Stern-Gerlach experiment is, in goes your spin, and if it's an up spin, it goes up. That's where the up spins go. If it's a down spin, it goes down. What happens if it's a superposition of a spin? Does it go in the middle, or does it go up, down? Okay, I like the last answer. It never goes in the middle, and this is very surprising. You can start off with a half, you can start off anything you want, it will always either go up or down. And what happens is it will go up with some probability, and that probability is going to be magnitude of A squared. And it's going to go down with some probability. Magnitude of B squared. And so that's the physical meaning of those quantities A and B. And you can build a Stern-Gerlach machine, and you'll notice that it always goes either up or down. And as I said, if you put in an up spin, then A is equal to 1, B is equal to 0, so it always goes up. What does this tell us about A and B? Well, if it always does one or the other, then the probability of the two has to sum to 1. Magnitude A squared plus magnitude B squared equals 1. Okay. Life would be pretty boring if all we could do was up and down. As physicists, we've evolved at least two dimensions, and we can do left and right. And so let me explain left and right space. You've roughly seen them today as well, possibly by a different name. Remember, right spin is simply superposition of up and down, which is 1 over root 2 up plus 1 over root 2 down. A left spin is 1 over root 2 up minus 1 over root 2 down. We can invert these equations, and it will be useful to do it later. We can also write an up spin as 1 over root 2 a right spin plus 1 over root 2 a left spin. And the downspin is, you may have guessed, exactly the same thing with a minus. So it's very symmetric. What does up and down mean? Well, yes?
Up and down.
Yes, sorry. Sorry, actually, I meant that. What does left and right mean? We know what up and down means. It means exactly that.
It means up
send down in a different way.
Well, basically it means there's actually another Stern-Gerlach experiment, which is a version of that Stern-Gerlach experiment, but rotated by some 90 degrees along some axis. And in that case, what happens is the Stern-Gerlach experiment always sends right spins up or to the right, depending on how you think of it, and it sends left spins always in the other direction. So there's a different Stern-Gerlach experiment that measures left versus right. So we call this original Stern-Gerlach experiment, it's a measurement in the z basis. There's the other Stern-Gerlach experiment, where you go up for right, and you go down for left. And we're going to call this the measurement in the x basis. Exactly the same time. Actually, this is a good time to start erasing this board. Okay. So this is roughly the mathematics of one spin. But there's something very deep that's already on the board here, which is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle sort of materialized out of nowhere. And you're usually accustomed to hearing about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle for position and momentum. There's an uncertainty principle for spin as well. It says if you know what z component of the spin, then you have no idea what the x component of the spin is. If you know what the x component of the spin is, you have no idea what the z component of the spin is. And we can look at this exactly from these equations. Say I knew that I had a right spin, and then I measured it in the z basis. By the rules I wrote down, I get with a half probability up, with a half probability down. If I had a left spin, I also get a half left and a half down, a half up and a half down. If I started with an up spin, and chose to measure it in the x basis, left or right, then again, with a half probability I get right, with a half probability I get left. So magically, we've found an uncertainty principle lurking in this sort of the simple mathematics. What does this mean? Well, this is exactly what I mean that we cannot measure the state and learn everything about it. Say you have a friend and he gives you a spin. If he gives you a spin and he promises that it's either going to be an up or a down spin, then you're set. You run your Stern-Gerlach experiment in the z basis, you see if it's up or down, and you're perfectly happy. If your friend guarantees you that it's either right or left, then you run the measurement in the x basis and you find out whether it's right or left. But what if your friend gives you one of these four and doesn't tell you which one? Well, you could choose to measure it in the z basis. If he gave you an up one, you'll guess correctly. If he gave you a down one, you'll guess correctly. But if he gave you a right or a left one, you have no idea. There's a technical point that I should mention. It's very important. When you measure in quantum mechanics, the state is effectively replaced by the outcome you get. So if I start with a right spin, and I measure it in the z basis, and I get up, state of the spin changes to up. Whatever the information was that it was before, whether it was up or left, is lost forever. You get one measurement, and that's it. If that weren't true, then I could measure, in the up base, in the Z basis, and then in the X basis, and then the Z basis again, then the X basis again, many, many times until I got some information. But that doesn't happen in quantum mechanics. You get one shot to measure, and that's it. So if you get one shot to measure, and you're given one of these four at random, you're never going to be able to figure out which one it is. So that's the difficulty in teleportation. So what I want to do is, for some reason, my friend gave me one of these, and I don't know which one it is. And now I want to teleport it over to lab B. If I were to measure it and try to communicate the results classically, as we had in the giant fax machine, this would fail. However, there's going to be something else that we can do. So this is the mathematics of one spec. Let's talk about the mathematics of two specs. So if there are two spins, well, each of them can be up. One could be up, one could be down. One could be down, one could be up, and they could both be down. So there are four possible states. And their superposition is the most general state that you can have of two spins. What does A mean?
The probability then both spins are near a square root.
Yeah, so the square, well, the magnitude square of A, I guess, is the probability that both spins are up. Magnitude B squared is the probability that this one is up and this one is down. And so on and so on and so forth. What if I only measured the first spin? What's the probability of finding the first spin up?
A squared plus B squared.
That is actually a tricky question, but the correct answer is if you measure, we measure spin 1 and Z, get both. We get the up answer with magnitude A squared plus magnitude B squared. Simply by consistency, I know the probability of getting, you know, up up and up down is magnitude A squared and it's magnitude B, and probability of getting, you know, either of those is simply the sum of those two probabilities. Probability for getting down is simply magnitude C squared plus magnitude D squared. What is the state of the system after I measure the first spin? The state of the first spin is up, but actually the second spin is not damaged, and that's pretty good. Because if every time I measured one little piece of a system, the entire system got damaged, we'd be in a heck of a lot of trouble. I might measure my cup of water, and suddenly all of you collapse. So that is good. So the first spin is actually going to collapse. But the other one is going to remain roughly the same. So let's assume I got up. Roughly speaking, what do I have? Well, I get all the states that had up, and none of the states that had down for the first spin. So I get A up plus B, up plus B up down. What's the problem with this state? Probability doesn't add up to 1. So this state can't be the exact final state I end up with. What I really end up with is simply a state that's proportional to this, whose probability just happens to sum that's happens to sum to 1.
So we divide for A squared.
Yes, we divide by magnitude of A squared plus magnitude of B squared. We divide by the square root of A squared plus B squared. Okay, that's two spins. Why are two spins interesting? Because two spins can have entanglement. Okay. So we're going to study, and we're going to use a state, an entangled state called the singlet state. It's simply written as up, down, from the coefficient of 1 over root 2, minus 1 over root 2, down, up. It's an entangled state of the two spins. Maybe the a very important entangled state. What's the probability, if I measure the first spin, of getting up? 50%. And so 50% for getting down. What's the probability of, if I don't measure the first spin, but measure the second spin instead, of getting up? 50%. OK. So we basically seem to have no information about what the first spin is. We seem to have no information about what the second spin is. But what happens if I measure the first spin and get it up? What is the second spin? Down. If I measure up, then I simply project onto this state, and we erase this state. And all we end up with is here, so it ends up being down. So if I know, if I measure, so I don't know what the first spin is. I don't know what the second spin is. But if I know what the first spin is, immediately I know what the second spin is. Is that freaky?
How does that work?
Who thinks that this is sort of strange quantum mechanical?
He thinks it's witchcraft and heresy.
No, I'm not.
So, well, we'll take a poll. Raise your hand if you think that this is crazy quantum mechanical. Raise your hand if you think this is not crazy quantum mechanical. I count 1, 2, 3, 4 people who are right. Yes, this is not crazy quantum mechanical. There's a very easy way of doing this. And you know, you can try this with a friend after the lecture. How do you do exactly the same thing? Take a friend, ask him to draw on a piece of paper either an up arrow or a down arrow without telling you what it is, say 50-50 probability. Take the sheet of paper and without looking at it, run it through a photocopier. Now you have two pieces of paper, each of which an up arrow or a down arrow. Now you have no knowledge of what the first paper is. You have no knowledge of what the second paper is. But as soon as you look at one of the two papers, you know exactly what the other paper is. You might say, well, in that case they were the same, and in this case they're opposite. Well, no trick. After the photocopying, you flip one paper around by 180 degrees. And now they're opposite. So this shouldn't be all that surprising. But this isn't the only thing that the singlet state does. The singlet state has a property that, one, in every basis, it is 50-50. So the point is that a classical paper can only be measured in one particular way. You flip it over, and that's it. A quantum spin can be measured in many ways. You can measure it in the z direction. You can measure it in the x direction. I haven't spoken about them, but they're y directions. There are directions between x and z, and all crazy other stuff that you can do. And in all of them, you basically get 50-50 outcomes. Lifesaver. Big chunks are multiplying. Where? Okay. What's the other thing that happens for this state? Two, is that for every basis, if we measure both spins in the same basis, we always get opposite results. And so, as if you're curious, you should be able to rewrite this state in the left and right basis. And this state is exactly equal to 1 over root 2 right, left, minus 1 over root 2 left, right. But I told you that they're roughly anti-correlated. So these two things are exactly the same thing. And you can play around with the algebra to get them. Yes?
But how can you guarantee they are on two?
Well, if I measure one and measure the other one, I get opposite results. I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Why is that?
It's roughly the same reason as in the paper, as in the examples where I had the photocopier. We prepared them in that particular way. We created these in a way such that we know that they're opposite. That's what we created in the photocopier. We created two spins that happen to be opposite. We created these two spins so that they'd be opposite. And we there's a quantum mechanical process that tells that, like a quantum photocopier. Okay. So now we have our singlet state. Now we are approaching, So far we've spoken only about measurements. Sorry, Julian. But there are other things that we can do other than measure a quantum system. It would be a shame if all you can do is a quantum system measure. You can do operations that don't destroy the quantum information. What's an operation that does that? Well, the rotation. You take a spin, you rotate it by, say, 180 degrees around the x-axis. You don't know what you started with, you don't know what you ended with, but whatever you ended with is a rotated version of whatever you started with. These operations are called unitaries, and I believe you discussed them a little bit earlier. And so there is the unitary that I mentioned before, the rotation around the x-axis by 180 degrees, simply sends the upspin into the downspin. It sends the downspin into the upspin. How do I know I haven't lost any information here? That's true. How can I recover the original information?
Rotate
it again. If I want to recover whatever the original information was, I apply x a second time, and I get back the same thing, which is a rotation by 360 degrees is simply doing nothing. There's another very important unitary called the z unitary. The z unitary is a rotation by 180 degrees around the z-axis. On the up, well, roughly speaking, it changes the left into the right and the right into the left. What does it do on an up state? Nothing. Very good. What does it do on the down state? I presume you've seen this stuff. Good. It roughly speaking, it's hard to explain why it changes the sign. It's necessary for certain consistency requirements. The sign doesn't mean much. So if you take magnitude squared, it basically doesn't change the probability of measuring stuff in the z basis. It does change stuff when you measure them in other bases, but we knew that. We know it changes the probability of measuring left versus right. And that's what that sign roughly is doing. If you look at the x operator, actually the x operator leaves the right guy invariant, but puts a minus sign to the left guy. Yes?
So for the z function on the up arrow, if you have a negative up arrow, you get a positive up arrow?
No, you're going to get a negative up arrow again. So one of them changes sign, one of them doesn't change sign. But whatever you have here, if you put a 2 here, it's always linear. So any constant you put here will simply reappear on the other side. There's one final unitary, which we're going to have to discuss, unfortunately, which is a 2-qubit unitary, which is full of the controlled x. And it's simply abbreviated cx. And it does the following thing. It takes an up-up state, and it leaves it alone. It takes an up-down state, and it also leaves it alone. It takes a down-up state, and now it flips the second down-down. And it takes a down-down state, and it has to flip it by consistency to a down. Now, there's an obvious way of sort of implementing this operation. You measure the first thing in this in the z basis, and if you measure an up spin, you leave the second spin alone. If you measure a down spin, you flip it. But this is a measurement. This would destroy information. It turns out that you can actually implement this operation as a unitary without doing any measurement, without destroying any information. And it can be implemented reasonably efficiently in a laboratory, so long as both of these spins are in the same laboratory. In fact, this is one of these operations that creates entanglement, which is why it really needs to be both spins in the same laboratory. Okay. That's the way of raising. So now we're ready for defining teleportation. There are going to be three spins in teleportation. Spin one is the unknown spin. It's going to be one of, well, it could really be anything, but for today's lecture, we're going to assume it's simply going to be one of these four possibilities. It's either going to be a right spin, a left spin, an up spin, or a down spin. And that's what we mean by unknown. It's one of those four possibilities, but we don't know which one. It's going to be in lab A, because that's where our unknown spin starts off. Spin two and three are entangled. They're simply disentangled states, which we had over here. 1 over root 2, up, down, minus 1 over root 2, down. And spin 2 isn't going to start off in lab B. Spin 3 obviously starts off, spin 2 starts off in lab A. Spin 3 starts off in lab B. And so this is our entangled state, which will get destroyed. This is our spin, which we're trying to teleport. And at the end of this procedure, what will happen is that spin 3 will have a state that's exactly the same as whatever we put into spin 1 at the beginning. Spin 3 is the output of this. It's the only spin that's in lab B, and that's what we're trying to teleport to. Whatever we put into spin 1 will eventually appear in spin 3. Does that roughly make sense?
Can you repeat this one more time?
Spin 1 is the unknown spin. We're trying to teleport it somewhere. Where will it end up? Spin 3. Spin 3 is in lab B. Spins 1 and 2 are in lab A. Okay, so now I'm going to write down the rules of quantum teleportation. There are 5 of them. I should actually say that when I call them the rules, it's really kind of a misnomer. There are many rules for quantum teleportation. There are many, many ways you can actually teleport an object. There are also many, many different entangled states which are good for teleportation. And I simply randomly chose one and randomly chose a set of rules that work. They're all roughly related. And you can all see them. You can sort of transform one into the other. But if you ever open up a book in quantum computing someday, when you go to college, you'll probably find a different set of rules. Slightly different. But they're all equivalent, is what I can roughly guarantee. So the five steps of cooking with quantum computing. Step one. We apply a controlled X to spins 1 and 2. Step 2. Copy these so I get the light. Measure, spin 2 and Z. Step 3. You measure, spin 1 in the X axis. Step 4, and we haven't been speaking about our phone lately, but remember there was a phone connecting systems A and B a long time ago? Well, in step 4, we use phone. What do we use the phone for? We send the outcomes of step 2 and 3 over to lab B. So at the moment, steps 1, 2, and 3 can all occur in lab A without any help from lab B. Step 4, we simply and tell wherever is in lab B what the outcomes of these two measurements are. Finally, in step 5, we're going to apply a correction to the output spin, depending on what we get over here. So we're going to have a table. If the outcomes for this, then we're going to apply to spin 3 the following unitary operator. So if we got right and down, we do nothing. Left and down, we apply a Z. Right and up, we apply an X. And left and up, we apply an X. And then we apply a Z. Step 5 can be done entirely in lab B. But step 5 has to happen after step 4, which has to happen after step 3 and 2, which has to happen after step 1. So what does this tell us about the speed of teleportation?
It's not instantaneous.
It's only as fast as the speed of light. It's only as fast as this telephone. And this telephone, being a regular classical telephone, is bounded by the speed of light.
Only as fast as the speed of light.
It could be slower. I mean, it could take you a while to measure stuff. It could take you a while to reassemble stuff on the other side. It could be very slow. But it's certainly no faster than the speed of light. So unfortunately, no superluminal communication or jumps with this. So can I prove this? Well, maybe we'll prove a very simple case. If you want to teleport those four states, then there are four possibilities. There are four possible outcomes that you could have gotten. So there are roughly 16 things, 16 cases that you really want to check. Maybe I'll check four of them for you, the four easiest. And then as homework, I'm kidding. And then someday in your future career as physicist, you can check the other 12. So let's assume the spin 1 is in the up state. Spin 2 and 3 are in that state over there. What does this mean for the combined system? Well, the combined system is simply, roughly speaking, the problem. So the two of them combined into this bigger system that can be written as 1 over root 2, up, up, down. Because we know the first spin is always up. And the amplitude for the other one is 1 over root 2 for being up and down, minus 1 over root 2, up, down, up. So this is the way you sort of combine quantum states when you have two separate systems. Now, let's go through the steps of quantum teleportation. First, we apply a controlled X. What happens to spins 1 and 2? What happens when we apply the controlled X? Nothing. Because it says, if the first spin is up, we do absolutely nothing. So that's good. That's fairly easy. Maybe this is why I chose this case. Okay, measure spin 2 in the Z base. Actually, we're going to examine only one out of the 16 cases because we're running out of time. So you have now 15 cases of homework. You get to choose. What do I get? Do I get spin up or spin down for measurement 2? Who's going to scream it up first?
Down.
Down. I got down. Okay, so I ended up in this state. Now, we can rewrite this. Well, so it should have, as I said, you simply project down after the measurement, you get a state that looks like this. Where did the 1 over root 2 go away? It went away through the normalization. Where did the sign go away? Well, it turns out that overall signs don't really matter. If you multiply a state for an overall sign, it's not very important. We can worry about that a little bit later. What happens now when I measure this in the Z basis and the X basis? I'm going to measure this guy. But we can rewrite this as 1 over root 2, right, down, up, plus 1 over root 2, left, down, up. Well, it is kind of getting trivial at this point. Whether or not I get left or right, because I get to a 50-50 probability, what's the last spin going to be?
Up.
Up. What did I want the last spin to be?
Up.
Up. So what have I done? I teleported the spin. Maybe this was the easiest case, but roughly you can sit down and look at all 16 cases like this, and I guarantee you that they all work. Oh, we have to apply the correction. Sorry, very important. But what do the corrections tell us? Well, if we have down, we measure down and left. We do nothing, so we really do an up and up. If we have down and right, or down and left, as in this case, we apply a Z operator. What does the Z operator do in an up spin? Nothing. So we end up with the up spin. Yay, we teleported our first spin. Okay, can we actually teleport spins? Well, yes.
Can we teleport people?
Can we teleport people? Probably not.
Do you think we'll ever be able to?
No.
Just no.
The probability of this will turn off.
Just no.
Okay, so these are two slides that our very own Damien prepared for last year's talk, and I've been lazy enough to just simply plagiarize them from him, but they have some very pretty pictures. I think this takes a few minutes to stir up. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Ah. What did he do? Oh, it works better. Okay, so this is the first quantum teleportation experiment done about 1997 in Vienna, Austria. He teleported roughly one photon, and it says a distance of about 50 centimeters. But 50 centimeters was roughly the length of that table. Where is lab A and lab B? Well, lab A and lab B are simply roughly the left-hand side and the right-hand side of that table. And they teleported the spin all the way across the table. So that's kind of nice. We've been improving quite a lot, and the same group actually teleported a spin all the way to 600 meters in 2004. There are many other groups who've done quantum teleportation, and we can do quantum teleportation roughly on, say, the spin of an atom, a laser pulse, and a bunch of other stuff. But roughly speaking, we really always teleport, or almost always teleport, one quantum degree of freedom, one spin. Can we teleport more than that? Well, yes. I mean, if I repeat the experiment many, many times, then if I repeat it two times, I teleported two spins. If I repeat it three times, I teleported three spins. So apparently, we can definitely teleport at least three spins. But that's not quite what you really, really want. What you really, really wanted was to take a whole composite system and teleport it together. And roughly speaking, at this moment, we can't teleport very much. Spin, I think, maybe two spins. That's about it. What will the future look like? Well, I'll make a prediction. And if I'm wrong, you can come back 30 years from now and scream at me. Within 30 years, we probably should be able to teleport 1,000 spins. If we can build a usable quantum computer, then roughly the same technology should allow us to teleport roughly 1,000 spins. We will eventually probably teleport millions of spins. Tens of millions of spins. But that's very, very different from teleporting a person. We will probably never, ever, ever teleport a person. But nevertheless, you know, it's possible. And this is what today's lecture was trying to show us, is classically, teleporting a person is trivial. It's just a very difficult engineering problem, but that's a problem for the engineers. Quantum mechanically, it seemed very non-obvious. For 70 years, people thought that quantum teleportation would be impossible. Then they realized, oh, it's actually possible. It's just very, very, very hard. And to us, that's all the difference. Thank you very much.